Coming up on the Inside Indiana Business Television podcast, what's the state of organized labor in Indiana? An Indianapolis tech company is hosting what it says could be Indiana's version of South by Southwest. Our Endangered Indiana series travels to Elwood. We take a look at changes to an annual charity event in Indy. We'll get an update on a much-publicized COVID-19 study. Two Hoosier higher education institutions are partnering up. We'll get a preview of the first eSports Combine, plus a new nonprofit aims to create positive change for women. Welcome to the Inside Indiana Business Television Podcast. I'm Alex Brown. Labor Day in the United States honors and recognizes the American labor movement and the works and contributions of laborers to the development and achievements in the U.S. The Indiana State AFL-CIO represents more than 400 local unions across the state, representing nearly 300,000 Hoosiers. Indiana AFL-CIO President Brett Voorhees joined Gary Dick with more on what issues are facing organized labor and what the future could hold.
Labor Day, a great time to kind of take a break, relax, and think about labor in Indiana, in the U.S. As you look at the state of labor in Indiana, how would you assess it?
I'd say organized labor is on the rise. I think we've done really well here in Indiana. We've, as a matter of fact, in 64, the right now labor unions are at a high of 64% approval rating, which is the highest in 50 years now. Indiana the same way. We've due to the pandemic, we've been getting our phone calls left and right, people wanting to join a union and have some type of protection on the job and have more of a voice on the job, because we're certainly going through some different times people need voice, on the work, especially our essential workers.
Yeah, and as you look on the positive side, I know we were talking off camera, a lot of building construction going on around the state of Indiana. The building trades continue to see a lot of work statewide.
They do. And all the way from Northwest Indiana down to Madison, into Evansville. I mean, it's been booming. Our trades have been very busy. We've been very fortunate for the last well over a year now, even during the pandemic. As a matter of fact, it's gotten to the point to where some of the trades can't get enough apprentices to come in and work. So it keeps the job training going, keeps the apprenticeships full, and keeps the education going. So hopefully it stays that way going through the pandemic and then years to come.
Yeah, you mentioned the approval rating being up for unions in Indiana. At the same time, union membership has certainly been a challenge in Indiana, reached its peak in 1989. I think it's low last year in 2009. How are you addressing, or how do you need to address, the union membership issue in the state?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has been due to layoffs, whether it be UAW, GM plants, or other manufacturing around the state. Unfortunately, in the past few years, we've lost some facilities like Carrier and Rexnord Link Belt, which is the plant that I came out of. Unfortunately, due to no fault of their own, jobs moving overseas just moving manufacturing out of our state.
Yeah. Impact of right to work that got a lot of attention a few years ago. Now that we're a few years beyond the passage of the right to work law, has that had an impact on labor?
It really hasn't, Gary. And we've, as a matter of fact, the year after right to work got through, we had the highest organizing membership numbers in history of the Indiana AFL-CIO. Our numbers have stayed fairly stagnant through that whole process, and I feel like lost my train of thought there. Yeah. I apologize, but we are starting to thrive. People are wanting to join a union now. We are starting to grow even more so.
Yeah. How about trade policy? The new NAFTA, if you will, a trade agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. A lot of people in organized labor seem to like that, as we hear nationally. Your take on the new NAFTA and how that might impact Indiana?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the president has us heading in the right direction. NAFTA was certainly a job killer for most, all the way up until today. And although the new NAFTA Still has a long way to go. There's still a lot of things to be worked out, but it's certainly headed in the right direction on bringing more manufacturing here and preventing it from going overseas.
Yeah, only have about 30 seconds left, Brett, but want to get your take. Technology, automation, artificial intelligence, all those things stand to reduce potentially the number of people on the job. How does the AFL-CIO and others in organized labor address this issue of artificial intelligence and technology?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have to make sure that we are doing everything we can, working with our government, working with our employers on job training, on the new innovation and motivation that's coming through. We have to make sure that our companies are rewarding their employees. If you got to work a shorter work week, then so be it. But you could still pay that employee. One thing we have to do is make sure that money is going in the pocket to workers to make sure we keep our economy rolling.
All right. Brett Voorhees is the president of the AFL-CIO here in Indiana. Brett, really appreciate the time and some really good perspective on Indiana labor. Thanks for joining us.
Still to come, our Endangered Indiana series visits a historic library in Madison County, and an Indianapolis charity event goes year-round. But first, Indianapolis-based MetaCX is a high-alpha studio company that raised more than $14 million in early funding to transform, it says, how businesses manage their customers and how customers manage their vendors. Scott McCorkle is the founder of the company, and CEO and President Jake Sarofman is leading MetaCX from his home base in North Carolina. But even remotely, he's been immersed in the Indy Tech Center, and he talked with Gary Dick about the Customer Room, which he says could be Indiana's version of South by Southwest.
Before we get into some of the meat here, I wanted to touch on the model for MetaCX, another successful high alpha company, raised $14 million, launching in 2018. Customer lifecycle management software, SaaS company. Give us the thumbnail model of MetaCX.
Yeah, at the highest level, MetaCX is a platform that helps companies and their customers win together. And what I mean by that is that too often, suppliers and buyers of software and digital services really don't understand each other. And we think the essence of that misunderstanding is around what the customer is trying to achieve when they purchase software. No one buys software because they think, you know, it has cool features and it's neat. They buy software because they have some business challenge that they want to solve for. And companies do a pretty poor job at documenting, much less proving that they're achieving those outcomes on behalf of their customer. So that's exactly what MetaCX is doing, is providing a consistent way for suppliers and buyers to align around a shared view of success and to use that as sort of the steel thread that runs through the relationship that we're always referring back to and tracking progress against with real data.
Yeah. Jake, want to give people an idea of your background. As I mentioned, MetaCX raised $14 million, big capital raise there. You came on board as president and CEO of the company in the spring. Your background is very substantial in the tech world.
Yeah, so I joined in April as president and Scott as CEO.
Okay.
But I spent the last better part of three years as CMO of a company called Pendo in Raleigh, which was a bit of a rocket ship ride. It grew really, really fast. When I joined the company, just over 100 employees. When I left, 450. We raised $150 million, grew to a $1 billion valuation. Just a really extraordinary, fulfilling professional experience. And before that, I was a VP and chief of research at Gartner, looking after digital marketing and CMO topics. And that's where I got to know Scott McCorkle.
Right.
When he and crew were at ExactTarget and then through the Salesforce acquisition. So really thrilled to join him.
Good. Jake, give us the thumbnail on the Customer Room. It's an event that's coming up that you and others at MetaCX really have some big expectations for.
Yeah, so the Customer Room is a digital event that we are hosting the week of September 21st. It's a five-day event, but don't worry, we're not asking people to sit in their home offices for 5 days straight. We have sort of a flexible registration model, two sessions per day, 25 speakers. Register for whatever you're interested in. Ignore the rest. You're better off watch them later on demand.
Yep.
And this is really focused on sort of rethinking customer experience and customer relationships in a pretty trying time for a lot of companies.
Yeah, give us quickly, South by Southwest is an iconic event, really a trendy event down in Austin, Texas. You really think that this could be, in some level over time, that kind of an event for Indiana?
Well, look, I mean, we're modest people, so that's a high. It's flattering to think of it in those terms, but we do take inspiration from events like that, and we see this as an opportunity to really experiment with the medium and make it a bit eclectic. We've partnered with some really well-known musicians from Nashville who have been displaced by COVID-19, and they're both entertaining our audience. And also we've given them a platform to deliver a social message around what it means to be a creative artist in a time like this, when you're dependent on touring and things like that just simply don't exist.
Very good.
We do have a bit of a social mission associated with this as well.
Very good. Jake Sarofman is the president at MetaCX. Jake, thanks for joining us. We look forward to talking to you soon. Thanks for joining us from North Carolina.
My pleasure. Thanks, Gary.
All right.
Later in the podcast, an annual charity event in Indianapolis makes a major change, and we get an update on a much-anticipated COVID-19 study. But now, at the turn of the 20th century, steel magnate Andrew Carnegie offered up his millions to build public libraries across the U.S., Hoosiers took advantage of his generosity and secured funding for more than 160 libraries, more than any other state in the country. But as our Mary Rachel Redmond reports, this Carnegie Library, located in Madison County, is particularly special and, unfortunately, in danger of becoming extinct.
My opponent and his associates on the New Deal ticket.
80 years ago, Elwood native Wendell Willkie was nominated as the Republican candidate to face FDR for the presidency in 1940.
To outdistance Hitler in any contest he chooses in 1940 or after.
And despite giving FDR his closest election, ultimately his bid was unsuccessful. But one could argue the Willkie name had far more reaching benefits for the community of Elwood outside of the political arena.
This is a treasure to have in your local community here in Elwood.
Andrew Carnegie was once the richest man in the world. And at the turn of the century, he began offering his millions to communities across the country to build public libraries. Enter Wendell's parents, Herman and Henrietta Willkie, key players in securing this Carnegie Library for the city of Elwood.
The effort to get this library was extensive, and it paid off only after 6 years of working to get this library here.
In August of 1901, Elwood citizens wrote to Mr. Carnegie, informing the steel tycoon that their current library was so popular, in a matter of months, it would no longer be big enough. And the letter went on to say the city of Elwood did not have any citizens wealthy enough to purchase a new building and asked for his generosity.
After the plans were submitted for this particular library and then they reviewed them, they said that this was the ideal standard for library circulation. The Library of Congress actually recommended the Boston Public Library to model their construction after Elwood's library here in Indiana. Both the architecture is intact here, but also that circulation method is also intact here, and it remains. There's been very little alteration to the building itself.
The library would go on to serve Elwood citizens for nearly a century before going on the market in the mid-90s, and then remained vacant until 2018, when an out-of-state buyer purchased the property, but has done little to make improvements.
As the owner is from out of state, and I don't believe that they appreciate the true architectural value of what it means to the city of Elwood when the great memories we've had from residents that have grown up generation to generation.
The threat is that it's just sitting here vacant and of some leaking that was occurring that's caused mold growth in the basement. There are other issues that need to be repaired. You can see that there's paint that's failing. Some of the windows, the historic windows, need to be fixed or repaired. And so there are just some issues that if you let them continue to linger, other things are going to infiltrate it and the building will eventually start to crumble.
It's just sat empty for so long that it's something that we've been working hard to try to acquire the ownership of it so we can get in and fix it up and truly save a landmark in the city of Elwood.
I would like it to be turned into something, a business, a restaurant, a brewery, anything really. Just to preserve the actual architecture of the building would be wonderful.
It makes you shiver when you walk into that building and just the effort that's gone in there. It's a very impactful space. And I'm hoping that through our efforts and the owner's efforts and the community's efforts that we can get this building back to that space.
Mary Rachel Redmond, Inside Indiana Business.
Remember, you can catch Inside Indiana Business Television on stations throughout the state every weekend. Head to InsideIndianaBusiness.com to check listings. Still to come, the results of a major COVID-19 study are in, and two Indiana higher education institutions are teaming up. But first, an innovative partnership between the Rotary Club of Indianapolis and Selflessly will help Indy Dude Day continue year-round philanthropic efforts. The partnership will allow both organizations to meet the growing challenges by Central Indiana's nonprofits, and it could extend beyond Indiana. Rotary Club President Nick Reich and Selflessly co-founder Josh Driver joined us to talk about the partnership.
Nick, I want to start with you to kind of tee this up. The challenges facing nonprofits are enormous, especially with the pandemic. Give us your take on these challenges, Nick, and what it really is all about.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, as you know, all nonprofits are being hit extremely hard, both financially and with the need for volunteers. And the need has never been greater for volunteers, and the inability to have large groups, large numbers of volunteers is really hindering a lot of our nonprofit partners. So the ability to create this opportunity to continue to meet the needs of our nonprofit partners, which need it now more than ever, is critical for our community.
Okay, we've got a premier player in the nonprofit space in Rotary. Josh, Selflessly, give us the thumbnail sketch of Selflessly and what the company is all about.
Yeah, we're a certified B Corp and a platform for companies to be able to accelerate their philanthropy through giving, volunteerism, and donations of products and services. Our mission is to be breaking down the barriers between the for-profit and nonprofit sector, and it just makes sense for us to be investing in our own community by supporting organizations that are creating that ecosystem of good.
All right, the two of you getting together on a partnership. And Nick, this is going to take Indy Dude Day, which has typically been like a three-day event, community event for community improvements and volunteer efforts, and extending that into really basically a year-round philanthropy. Nick, talk about what this means for this event, Indy Dude Day.
This would have been our seventh year as the Rotary Club of Indianapolis championing Indy Dude Day for the community. We recognize that Indianapolis is the most philanthropically and civically engaged community in the country, and we're excited to continue to promote that as one of the large service clubs in the organization. You know, one of the things that's really important to us was not just to have 3 days of service, but our nonprofit partners really need that support year round. So we still desire to have in 2021 these 2 or 3 days of really large scale events for the community. But we also know that the need is year round, and we wanted to create a partnership that would help fill that need.
Josh, unfortunately, we have about 30 seconds, but give us the thumbnail of what you're going to do and how you're going to make these things happen with technology.
Yeah, so we built a platform that's free for nonprofits to create volunteer opportunities and request donations. And so we're going to be implementing some technology to help connect people to specific organizations and needs over time, and really grow this and just be that hub for all things good in Central Indiana.
And it indeed could extend beyond Indiana over time. Nick Reich and Josh Driver, great partnership. We look forward to following. Thanks for joining us.
Later in the podcast, a unique partnership between two Hoosier higher ed schools, and Central Indiana gets to host the first esports combine. But now, a recent IU School of Medicine COVID-19 study on children and adults in Marion County focused on those who do not display any symptoms of the disease. Most COVID-19 studies only key in on adults, but the outcomes revealed why it's just as important to include asymptomatic children. The results are in, and they help answer some big questions that parents and school leaders have been wrestling with as students head back to class. Business of Health reporter Kylie Valletta has more.
The results now show that asymptomatic COVID-19 infection is possible in children under 10, but it is a very low number. And these asymptomatic kids may not be as contagious as previously thought. The insights shed light on issues surrounding school. Here to help us sort through those is Dr. James Wood, the study's co-leader and an infectious disease doctor at Riley Hospital for Children. Dr. Wood, thank you for being on the show today.
Appreciate you having me.
So this study, it's the first of its kind in the U.S. What makes it so unique, even on a national scale?
Yeah, so we were able to go into the community and test families, including young children, as you mentioned, which was really important to us. We really wanted to focus on kids under 10 and kids of all ages, because that's just an area where this disease hasn't been studied enough, in our opinion, to go out into the community. So we were able to test people that weren't having to come to the hospital or weren't able to go to a study site, for example. So it gave us a little bit better idea of what was actually going on in the community.
Okay, so the study sampled 511 people in Marion County. One of those tested positive for COVID-19, and interestingly, it was a 7-year-old. So tell us about that one case, and what are we learning from that one case in that child?
Right, so we did show that that a 7-year-old child was positive, and so that was really kind of the first of its kind that we were able to know that young children can have the virus asymptomatically. That's something we thought and probably figured was the case, but to be able to show it in a scientific study, you know, is really important. And I think as there's so much information that goes out, really showing that in a well-designed study is super important. And so we were able to do that. And what we were also able to see is that this child didn't infect other people in his household. And so, again, we can't make huge conclusions about how contagious kids are just from one case, but I think it does give me some and give us some optimism about growing research that is showing that maybe kids without symptoms aren't the, quote, super spreaders or aren't super as contagious as maybe once thought.
Right. Okay. So every parent is thinking about school right now. So what are your big takeaways from this study as far as school concerns?
Yeah, I think school is really a reflection of the community where it is. And so I think the big takeaways are, especially at that time in Marion County, numbers were relatively low in terms of asymptomatic kids that were or people that were infected. And so I guess what we can take away is that schools, you know, I think the goal is obviously to get back to in-person classes and in-person school. And so in an area where the transmission and the rates are low, I think that we can say that maybe the asymptomatic rate is fairly low as well, and we can feel better about continuing to do the safety precautions, but getting back into schools, which is obviously, I think, everybody's goal.
One thing you mentioned I thought was really interesting is throughout all this, the pendulum has sort of been swinging. It was first kids are super spreaders, and then it was swinging towards they're immune. And you think the answer really might lie somewhere there in between?
It usually does, and it's probably the case for this as well. I think that most likely kids are able to spread the virus. I think we know that, but probably not to the extent that maybe first thought where they were super spreaders. You know, respiratory viruses, kids do shed it and spread it quite a bit for whatever reason and for a variety of reasons. That probably isn't the case for COVID, but that doesn't mean that they're immune. So I think that being really cautious and kind of listening to health officials, keeping social distancing and masking is really important. But I do think that I'm optimistic that maybe they're not the source of outbreaks and infection, and that we can hopefully get them schools, you know, either keep them in schools or get them into school if they're not already.
Was interesting. This child living in a house with five other family members, and none of the family members have tested positive since, as you have followed them up. So you are planning a follow-up study. Tell us about that and what you hope to learn from a follow-up study.
Right. So what we were able to do for this study was look at one point in time. We did those nasal swabs, and we are looking at who had the virus at that point in time. What we want to know in the follow-up study is who has been exposed or who has had infection in the past, and the way we measure that is through those antibodies that people have heard of. And so our follow-up study is looking at the same cohort of people, but now testing the antibodies to see if any of those people may have been infected or been exposed to the virus and showed immunity to that at this point. And so that will give us a bit broader picture of exactly more in a longer frame of who's had the infection without symptoms.
Okay, I know that you are sharing the study results with decision makers at the state level. Thank you so much for being on the show today and helping us make a little bit more sense of the science.
Still to come, the first esports combine is coming up soon in central Indiana, and a new nonprofit aims to bring positive change for women. But first, Marion University in Indianapolis recently announced plans to expand again its footprint in the state through a strategic partnership with Ancilla College in northern Indiana. Beginning in July of next year, the new entity will be known as Ancilla Ancilla College of Marion University. Marion President Dan Elsener and Ancilla President Dr. Michelle Dvorak joined us with details on the partnership.
Dan, I want to start with you on this partnership, what it's all about, and really I think more broadly about this being part of a strategy and a vision that you have at Marion University.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. One of the things that's clear in higher ed is the business model behind the wonderful work we do to prepare teachers and business leaders and healthcare workers and all that is that you have to have scale of some sort, and you want to be close to your learners. So some years ago, we started developing teaching sites in Nashville, Tennessee, northern part of Marion County, Oklahoma City, et cetera. And we also started to talk to other campuses about forming a broad-based network of Catholic institutions of higher learning. And so we've been out talking to people, and interestingly, and I'll let Sister Michelle talk about this, but Ancilla had the same kind of strategy. We want to be part of a larger network for a thriving future. And so we found each other, and that's where we're at. And we think it's the future of higher ed.
Yeah. Sister Michelle, talk about that from Ancilla's standpoint. College in northern Indiana, Donaldson, Indiana. And really about 2 years ago, you began that process of looking for a potential partner, right?
Absolutely, we did. We used our geographical area, and we used also the search for Catholic institutions that we thought could provide more opportunity if we had a partnership with those Catholic institutions. And so then we moved that to Faith Base. We absolutely spent a good amount of time with our hand reached out saying, we want to grow, we want to stay in that area of Marshall County and respond to that larger area in northern Indiana. And well, we wanted to say that we didn't want a college to walk into the future unclear about where it would be into the future.
Yeah.
So that's the purpose. And
what will this mean for students and for Ancilla College? What will this partnership mean?
You know, our students at Ancilla College have for a goodly number of years asked us to expand to four-year programs, to have an education program, to expand classes and business. And we have not been able to do that. And so what it means for our students is that here at Ancilla Marion University, they get to do degrees, bachelor's degrees, and eventually graduate degrees.
All right, very good. Dan Elsener, let me switch over to Dan Elsener quickly. From Marion's standpoint, what does this mean for Marion University? You're continuing to grow. I know you have a vision of about 5,000 students now. Marion could be an 8,000 to 12,000 student university by the end of the decade.
Yeah, well, we're growing our main campus. We have a record enrollment in all areas, just about all areas this year. But also we see the future of higher ed with some scale. And so our board's committed to a strategy to find willing and mission-driven partners, because there's also a strategy we've had about building what we call pipelines. Pipelines that where you eliminate the leaks, where students can enter the higher education pipeline and have a clear line of sight to many opportunities. And it'll be a great thing for educational attainment in the state and beyond. And a great thing for business and healthcare and education.
And so you announced a partnership earlier with St. Joseph's College in Northwest Indiana. This really is, I think, emblematic of what's going on in higher education. Really, a different picture. Universities like Marion and Ancilla getting creative with strategy.
That's exactly right. We'll also start a nursing program up in Calumet this winter. And that's moving forward. So you use a base operation, leverage technology, find good educational nodes in various rural and other parts of the state where you can do both and deliver the benefits of a great big university but be close to the people and be in community with them.
Coming up, we'll hear about a new nonprofit aiming to bring positive change for women. But first, Indianapolis has long been host to the NFL Combine, showcasing the top college football players to professional franchises. But now Indy hopes to step into a new arena of combines for talent evaluation, esports. Bill Benner has more in this week's Inside Indiana Sports.
Esports is a burgeoning multi-billion dollar industry that has exploded onto the virtual landscape over the past several years, including on college campuses. So next month, the Indiana Sports Corp and a company called Harina Data will host a virtual esports combine that will bring together gamers and industry leaders for tournaments, training, educational roundtables, and other features. And joining us today to discuss is a familiar face, ISC President Ryan Vaughn. And Ryan, welcome to the program. Great to see you again, my friend.
Great to be with you virtually. Good to be with you nonetheless.
Well, yeah. And we are talking about the virtual landscape and esports. First of all, where did the idea foment to a partnership with Harina Data about this place for young folks to showcase their gaming talents?
Yeah, as I'm sure you and the viewers understand, you know, esports has just been exploding on the scene. And about 18 months ago, the Indiana Sports Corp got pretty serious about what that means for us and how that could be a value add to our overall sports package in Indy. And so we partnered with a group, Harina Data, which is local, that has national reach. They've hosted tournaments across the country. They have great connections in the world of esports and particularly with game and game designers. And we sat down and said, you know, where's a spot that we could engage and be effective and be unique? And so that's how we've settled on this esports combine concept.
And this was going to be an actual live combine at the Indiana Convention Center, but because of the pandemic, it did get moved to a virtual platform next month in October. But if anybody could do virtual, it would be these folks.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we sort of joke, you know, we've taken many of our programs virtual and had to teach our partners how to do so, but we're definitely learning from our partners in this instance. They have an incredible virtual footprint, and, you know, the show will always have some element of virtual presentation to it. But, yeah, I think it'll be an exciting and engaging opportunity for the athletes and for the scouts and colleges as well.
Ryan, talk about, again, esports. There is scholarships available. It is a rapidly, rapidly growing concept on college campuses. And again, a lot of great opportunities out there for young people.
Yeah, that's really what we settled on, this esports combine, because there's really nothing out there nationally that provides a pathway for an esports player to connect to either a pro team or a college or university that offers scholarships for those esports athletes. And so it seemed like a niche we could fill. You know, many people don't appreciate there are over 300 colleges and universities across the globe that offer scholarships. And many esports players are, you know, bound for higher education and particularly STEM-focused education. So for us, it became a natural pairing to showcase those skill sets from these great players who have aspirations to go to college and connect them with the scouts and recruiters who are looking for top talent.
Yeah, and here in Indianapolis, you know, obviously we think about Pacers Gaming for an example of a place where gamers can end up. But again, this is across the board. Many, many sports and gaming style activities are available out there.
Yeah, there really are. I mean, the number of platforms and games are somewhat limitless, and so far as a new one rolls out, you know, seemingly every week. But yeah, we've really concentrated on six of the top platforms, six of the games that are most compelling to those colleges and universities and that the players are highly engaged in. And so really excited about the connections that could be made here. And, you know, for us to be able to, you know, deliver an aspiring, you know, young adult an opportunity to gain some cash to support their college venture is just a unique and incredible opportunity.
And Ryan, as we wrap up, this will take place October 16th through the 18th. How would be if you're again, if you're a youngster and you want to get involved or learn more, where would you do that?
Sure, you can go directly to gyo.gg. That's gyo.gg is the homepage for where the event will be registering potential players, or you can just link from our website if you like at indianasportscorp.org.
And finally, for 36 years, Rabbi Sandy Sasso led Congregation Beth El Zedek in Indianapolis, and since retiring, she's put her energies into a new passion, Women for Change, an organization designed to educate, equip, and mobilize Hoosiers to create positive change for women. More than 800 showed up at Sasso's organizational meeting for the nonprofit, advocating on behalf of women for four things: economic stability, health, improved sexual assault laws, and fair voting practices. Executive Director Rima Shahid joined Gary Dick with more on the nonprofit's mission.
Let's talk about, and I gave a little bit of information there in the introduction, but Women for Change, this is an idea I think the organization launched in 2017, an outgrowth of the 2016 election and the really tough language, the divisiveness that really plagued that election. Talk about the organization and really the goals here.
So we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and we're really looking to get women to be more politically and civically engaged. I think women, we make up one of the largest voting blocks, and it's important that we do so and we take that power and make sure that we vote and are engaged in that process. I think by lifting up women and politically and civically, you not only lift that woman, but you lift the entire community and her family.
Yeah, and getting out the vote, I know you've got a couple of major initiatives underway right now. One is getting out the vote. Another is an event later in September here, Unfinished Business, which really marks and celebrates the 19th Amendment.
That's correct. So our immediate, we have an event next Saturday. It's called Unfinished Business, the State of Women in Indiana. I think it's important for us to remember that the 19th Amendment granted some women to vote, but it wasn't until 1965 that more inclusive. And so we're looking at how can we make positive change so that the next 100 looks a little bit different. And to that point, the most immediate thing that we can do is vote. And so we're looking to 4,000 Hoosiers to get out the vote. A majority of Hoosiers are either not registered, or if they're registered, they don't get to the ballot box. And so we're going to give it all that we have to make sure that Hoosiers do get out there and vote.
Yeah, you mentioned this is a nonpartisan organization. And I think the idea, this Women for Change, the organization, the idea really struck a chord. As I mentioned in the introduction, at that first, that organizational meeting, 800 people showed up. So really did strike a chord with a lot of people.
That's correct. I was unable to get into the door. But what we know is that when women work together, we work together in a nonpartisan, bipartisan way to really affect change in our community. And that's what's really important to us, is that we advocate for Hoosier women, regardless of political affiliation.
Yeah, and as you mentioned earlier, this is something that can lift all boats when it comes to the impact the organization can have in terms of things like pay equity and any number of issues that are challenges out there in the community.
Absolutely. I think women's economic stability, Indiana women, we are amazing, and we make up a large portion of the working force. And so we need to make sure that our laws are really helping Indiana women. We have other laws that need to be updated. And I'm sad to report that here in Indiana, we are fourth highest in the nation as far as sexual assault among high school girls. Again, regardless of political affiliation, as a mother myself, I know that's something that really plagues me and something that I advocate for on a daily basis is a passage of a law so that we can get Indiana off that list.
All right, a new organization with a big agenda, very topical now with the election as well. Women for Change. Rima Shahid is the executive director. Rima, thanks very much for joining us, and we look forward to following your progress and talking to you in the future.
Thank you. For those that would like to volunteer, please visit our website. We're looking to grow our community of volunteers and members. Thank you for having me.
Very good. You bet. We'll talk to you soon.
That wraps up this week's Inside Indiana Business television podcast. Remember, you can find all of this week's TV segments, as well as the top business news from throughout the state, at InsideIndianaBusiness.com. While you're there, you can also subscribe to our platform of free e-newsletters. This is Alex Brown for Inside Indiana Business.